WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's difficult to document a culture which is forced to remain hidden. Until the gay liberation movement, there was very little in the way of gay history. My guest, Lillian Faderman, is one of the writers who has been telling the story of this formerly invisible subculture. Faderman is a professor at California State University in Fresno and has written extensively about lesbian literature and history. Her new book, Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, is a study of lesbian subcultures through the 20th century. And she's found these subcultures have a lot to tell us about changing views of class, morality, and gender in America. In the 1950s, for instance, Faderman says the lesbian subculture was defined by class.
For example, middle-class women didn't dare generally to frequent the gay bars. Lesbian bars in those days were called gay girls' bars. They didn't dare participate in that visible aspect of the subculture. And so their subculture was often made up of private parties and dinner parties and things that were much less visible than what working class lesbians and young lesbians did. Young lesbians often went to gay girls' bars. Those bars frequently encouraged the establishment of butch and femme roles and role-playing and relationships such as tended not to exist in such an obvious way among middle-class women.
Why do you think that in the 1950s there was so much emphasis on butch and femme roles within
the working
relationships
class
between
community
women
and the young community? I want to emphasize not
so in the middle class.
Among middle-class women, but I think it was partly because roles in the parent society were just so pronounced, mm-hmm. so insistent. That is, men had to be manly men and women had to be very feminine women. And I think that young lesbians and working class lesbians were very influenced by the parent society. It's not true, I'm sure, for all women who found themselves in butch and femme relationships. I'm sure some of those women felt that it simply came natural to them. They were doing what was right for them. But within the bar scene, women who didn't feel particularly masculine or particularly feminine were frequently encouraged to choose one role or another and play that role within the relationship.
Well, you interviewed lots of women for your new book. Did you find that a lot of women did feel that they didn't fit in either butch or femme and had to choose one and felt uncomfortable after they did?
Yeah, I talk about some interesting stories that I was told in the course of these interviews. One woman, for example, told me that one night she was going to a bar to meet another woman who identified as a butch, and so she dressed in a very feminine way to be a counterpart to this other woman. The other woman didn't show up, and so the woman I interviewed decided that she would go to another bar, and in the car she changed clothes. She changed from her feminine clothes to her butch clothes because she said she just wanted to meet another woman, and butches had more opportunity to be aggressive, to introduce themselves, to take the dominant position in a relationship that they would start in a bar. And so, for her, it was extremely flexible.
Did she describe both outfits for you, by the way?
Yes, the femme outfit consisted of dangling earrings and high heels and a skirt, and the butch outfit consisted of penny loafers, which were very in the 50s, and she slicked her hair back in a ducktail, which was part of the guise, and she put a kind of T-shirt on and a sweater over it, and I think those pants were called in those days duck trousers, but it was almost a butch uniform that was popular in Los Angeles in the 1950s.
I feel compelled to point out that if you substitute the hair grease for mousse, you have the kind of basic way men and women dress today.
Right, yes. I think that's a good point. Now, of course, we have
except for the penny loafers. I don't know about the penny loafers.
Guys, right.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lillian Faderman, and she chairs the Women's Studies Department at California State University at Fresno. She's the author of a new book called Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, A History of Lesbian Life in 20th Century America. Well, in talking about lesbian subcultures, there's a really interesting and dramatic change that takes place in the latter part of the 1960s, both because of the counterculture and its attitudes towards love, and also because of the feminist movement. Let's start with the counterculture and, yes, and what was sometimes called free love. Did that put same-sex love into a different context?
Yes, I think it did, particularly coming out of phenomena such as the hippie movement, the New Left, the general tenor of the times in which experimentation was encouraged, the growth of the second wave of the feminist movement, and then, of course, at the end of the 1960s, the Stonewall Rebellion, the beginning of the gay liberation movement. I think that the 60s gave birth to a whole different kind of lesbian from the women that I first knew when I came out as a lesbian in the lesbian bars of the mid-1950s.
What are some of those differences?
Well, I want to distinguish, first of all, between two sets of lesbians. Some lesbians who worked within the gay liberation movement, who felt that where they hurt most was as homosexuals, and it was really to their benefit to bring about reforms to get rid of discrimination against homosexuals. There were other lesbians, however, who came out through feminism or who identified mostly as feminists, and they felt where they hurt most was not necessarily as homosexuals, but as women. That is, even if homosexuals had all sorts of freedoms, they would be discriminated against as women. And those women very often became feminists first and then radical feminists and then saw lesbianism as the only logical conclusion to feminism. And they became political lesbians first. That is, their attitude was any woman could choose to be a lesbian.
But don't you think it's interesting that in the late 1960s, perhaps for the first time in history, you have sexuality becoming in part a political and cultural decision?
Yes. Yes, I think that's true. And again, I think it comes out of the wonderful ferment and upheaval of the 1960s, where we felt that anything was possible, that that one could choose to live a lesbian lifestyle, and that it was a viable political and cultural choice.
You say in your book that since so many women decided to become lesbian to get away from sexist political or emotional relationships, that lesbianism became seen by some women as a cure-all for all the ills of sexism. And I wonder what kind of impossible expectations you think that put on certain lesbian relationships.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. It seems to me that many women who became lesbians during the 1970s expected those relationships to be utopian, to be perfect in every way. And of course, lesbian relationships are human relationships, and there's no way that human relationships can be simply perfect forever. And I think a number of those women were disappointed. Many of them then developed more realistic expectations and have remained lesbians. Others felt that since it was hard to live as a lesbian in a culture that was primarily heterosexual and relationships weren't perfect, they may as well go back to heterosexuality again. There's a term for those women, incidentally. They're called has-beens.
You say something in the book that I think is very funny. I'm not sure if you meant it to be funny or not. But you say in the 1950s, there was a lot of role-playing between butch and femme. In the 1970s, so many lesbian feminists just saw themselves as butch, just dressed butch.
Right. Right. I don't think they would have identified themselves specifically as butch if they were asked seriously, are you butch or femme? But I think the style was androgynous. I think that many radical feminists, and certainly lesbian feminists as part of the radical feminist movement, felt that it was playing into patriarchy to wear high heels and dresses and makeup and all of those artifacts of heterosexuality. Women did it simply to please men, and as lesbian feminists, of course, they would have nothing of it. And so their style tended to be very androgynous. They didn't have elaborate hairdos as opposed to heterosexual women. They refused any kind of makeup. And they wore clothing that they thought was comfortable and practical.
What kind of splits do you think there were in the 1970s between lesbians who came out primarily for political reasons, to get away from sexism, and lesbians for whom it was really more of a basic sexual orientation?
Yeah, there was some conflict during the 1970s on the basis of those different ways to come at lesbianism. I think that many women who had been lesbians long before the 1970s, old gays as they were called for a while, really felt that young lesbian feminists just didn't know what it was all about, that they came into lesbianism in an era of relative freedom, really vast freedom from the perspective of women who came out in the 1950s, and they took for granted all of these privileges. They had no way of identifying with the struggles of older lesbians, and so there was a lot of resentment on the one hand. But on the other hand, I interviewed a number of women who had come out in the 1950s and became lesbian feminists in the 70s. And they thought that they had died and gone to heaven, that you know, suddenly the whole world was open to them, that there were all of these wonderful cultural representations, such as women's music and women's novels. And what I mean by women is lesbian. The term was generally used synonymously at the height of lesbian feminism. Women's publishing houses, women's coffee houses, all sorts of cultural places to go and to be a lesbian.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lillian Faderman. She's the author of the new book, Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, A History of Lesbian Life in 20th Century America. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Lillian Faderman is my guest, and she chairs the Women's Studies Department at California State University at Fresno, and she's written a new History of Lesbian Life in 20th Century America. What is happening today with younger lesbians who are, you know, coming of age now, who are in their late teens or in their early 20s, their late 20s? Do you see a different kind of subculture emerging?
Yeah, I really envy younger lesbians, and I'm very happy for them. I don't know what the future is going to bring. I think if there's an economic depression in this country, and it looks like we're very close to one, there may be all sorts of reactions against any kind of diversity, and undoubtedly homosexuals will suffer from those reactions. But short of that, it seems to me that younger lesbians are coming into a much more open society, and in all ways more open than what I experienced coming out in the 1950s, and even more open than what lesbian feminists experienced, because I think there's much more choice now. One can be a lesbian feminist, as women were in the 1970s. One can be involved in a butch and femme relationship, as women, working class and young lesbians were in the 1950s. One could be a lipstick lesbian, which is a term that was current for a while in the late 1980s. And
what's this? Yeah.
A lipstick lesbian dresses in high heels and skirts and makeup, and still calls herself a lesbian, doesn't think there's any kind of uniform, as she would put it, that she has to don. There isn't any sort of appearance that she has to plug into. She can just do it her own way.
You write in the book that you believe that lesbians aren't necessarily born different. In other words, that it really might be a choice that you make as opposed to just something inherent in your makeup.
Right. I really think that the Kinsey scale established by Alfred Kinsey in the early 1950s is very telling about human sexuality. Kinsey created a scale from 0 to 6. 0 meant a person who was totally heterosexual. 6 meant a person who was totally homosexual. And what he discovered is that there were very few 0s and very few 6s. People who identified as heterosexual tended to be 1 or 2 on the Kinsey scale. That is, they had had some homosexual experience. People who identified as homosexual tended to be 4 or 5 on the Kinsey scale. They had had some heterosexual experience. What that indicates is that people are really diverse within their own lives sexually, and at any given time, a person can be heterosexual primarily or homosexual primarily. I think that's very good evidence of the fact that one isn't simply born heterosexual or born homosexual.
And you don't think there should be pressure on people to worry about consistency in their choices?
No, not at all. No, I think it's wonderful if people could feel open about who they are and open to express themselves according to whatever else is happening in their lives at a particular time.
You came out in the 1950s. Did you fit into any of the subcultures that you described earlier?
Well, I experienced various subcultures. I first was brought by a gay boy, as we called gay men in those days, to a gay girls bar that was a working class bar where butches and femmes were in very different kinds of roles. Really made distinctions between them. About a year later, I was taken by another friend to not a gay girl's bar, but a gay woman's cocktail lounge. Was one of the few middle-class lesbian bars in Los Angeles, the city in which I lived at that time. And there, the women didn't fit into butch and femme roles, at least not in any visible kind of way. The women generally wore tailored suits and high heels and makeup and were fairly uniformly feminine, at least in their visible appearance, although what they did in private might have been very different from their visible appearance. And so I sort of lived in both cultures for a period of time.
What made you comfortable and uncomfortable about each?
Well, I think what made me most uncomfortable about the working class and young lesbian culture. My first introduction to lesbian life was the insistence, the public insistence within those bars that one had to choose an identity, had to choose a self-presentation. It had to be either butch or femme. But what was so wonderful about that subculture was the bravery of those women. They risked a lot to be in those bars. They were really subject to raids by the vice squad practically weekly. In fact, I interview a woman from Worcester, or rather I quote an interview of a woman from Worcester, Massachusetts, who says that raids were so frequent every Friday and Saturday night in the working class bar that she used to go to, that they would make a joke of it. They would say, "Hurry up and finish your beer because we're going for a ride." That is, the paddy wagon was going to pull up momentarily and take them off. And it must have taken for women in a situation like that a terrific amount of bravery to risk being there, to create a kind of lesbian geography, to realize that they had to establish a place for themselves. And so that was really admirable, I think.
So when you were expected to choose butch or femme, which did you become?
It varied, I think, from week to week, depending on a particular mood. But I don't think I was ever especially comfortable in either of those roles. I was probably more comfortable in the gay women's cocktail lounge, where one didn't have to choose a specific role, at least in terms of self-presentation in a social situation.
What made you uncomfortable about that context, though?
I think what made me uncomfortable is those women really seemed to be much more frightened about who they were than working class and young women. They really felt that they had a lot more to lose. They often wouldn't certainly not give their last names upon meeting someone in a bar, and frequently not even give their real first names because they felt that it was just so dangerous to be in a gay bar in the 1950s. And of course, for many of them, it was not paranoia. It was at least a very well-justified paranoia. They were in danger if they had any sort of government position, if they worked for local government or state government as a teacher, for instance, or a social worker or a librarian. They really could lose their jobs and their livelihood if they were discovered to be lesbian.
When did the gay liberation movement start to directly affect your life?
I think it did as soon as I read about the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. That was so incredible that finally here were some homosexuals that would not simply stand for being taken off in a paddy wagon and booked and held overnight in jail and demeaned. At the same time, or immediately after that, there was the establishment of the lesbian feminist movement when suddenly thousands and thousands of women were saying what I had felt my whole life, that is, they were taking a feminist approach to politics, analyzing the world in feminist terms. And that, too, was extremely liberating for me.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
My guest has been Lillian Faderman, and she's the author of the new book, Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, A History of Lesbian Life in 20th Century America. She also chairs the Women's Studies Department at California State University at Fresno. This is Fresh Air.